Welcome to episode number 113 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we bring in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story or topic from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And joining us yet again is one of our favorite guests, Kevin Bunch. Kevin's here again to tell us about a piece of late 1970s console game history that isn't generally understood. This time around, we're going to learn about the Bally Professional Arcade, a system I have to admit I knew very little about before watching Kevin's recently published documentary about the system on his Atari Archive YouTube channel. As always, we'll give you a link in the show notes. Please go watch it. Kevin, welcome back to the Video Game History Hour.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for taking an interest in my weird specialty of late 70s video game systems.
Well, I mean, I don't know, this one I felt like was a long time coming. This one's been something that we've heard you rambling about, you know, the very obscure pieces of this for, I feel like it's been like a year now that you've had some level of concentration on this. Something I often struggle with on the show is trying not to regurgitate a guest content, right? But the introduction to your video really gets to the heart of what makes this thing worth discussing, what makes it so enticing. So let me just pose your question back to you. Is the Bally Professional Arcade a console or is it a computer? And what's the difference?
So I kind of consider it a console. Some of the folks I talk to for this consider it a computer. It's a very strange machine because it kind of straddles that line. Like a console, it's very sort of, it's a closed system in a lot of ways. You know, it's sort of designed around, here's your controller ports, here's your cartridges, plug them in, play them. That's how most people understand old video game systems, and I feel like for a lot of people, it's still how they understand the professional arcade. But what makes it more computer-like is that, well, they intended to have a computer add-on, you know, entirely.
They
but
all
never
did.
Happened. Yeah, they all did, and it never really worked out. But in this case, they also published a basic cartridge and a cassette interface that allowed people to use the dinky little 24-key keypad on the front of the machine to type in code and run programs. And you could save them and you could load them from cassette tapes like you could for other computers at the time, like the Apple II or the Commodore PET. And on top of that, there's an expansion port on the back where they intended the, you know, full computer expansion to attach into, but you know, folks figured out the pinouts on those and were able to, you know, construct their own RAM expansions or their own full keyboards. You could even attach a printer to the one cassette interface port. So people figured out all sorts of weird little hacks for this machine that sort of turned it into a de facto computer. I think at least a couple issues of the newsletters that that the fans of the machine shared amongst themselves were printed out on a Bally arcade setup.
I love that. So, I mean, you break this up, I think, very smartly into two parts here, which is sort of its corporate history and the, like, video game history as video game history is classically understood. Like, how did this come about and what was the company like and how did it sell and all of that good stuff. And we'll totally talk about that, too. But then the second half of this video is just like, okay, but what was its actual life like, you know? And it sounds like, although, you know, this is a system that didn't sell very well, had an extremely active community, you know, kind of shepherding it forward. It reminds me a lot of, like, Frank, the way you talk about the NES, where it's like, you know, Nintendo stopped licensing games after a certain point, but that did not stop the NES from continuing to exist in, you know, hundreds of other ways,
right?
Even literally today.
Yeah, it's like There was a quote unquote unofficial sort of aftermarket or whatever for the Atari VCS, for example. But I think the big difference there is that the Astrocade had really good tools and a support network and a newsletter and stuff where people could self-publish fairly easily. And I think that's what made it so interesting and remarkable to me. And I suspect to Kevin Bunch.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think the way you put it, like, what was this machine's actual life? Like, how did people really use it? That that kind of brings a tear to my eye, because that's such a fascinating and rare approach to these sorts of histories. You know, you can talk all day about, the Atari VCS. It sold so many copies. These games came out. They were big hits, or they, flopped hard. You could look through these old magazines or newspapers, and you can get a sense of what people thought about these things. In the case of the Bally system, these were enthusiasts who were just sort of talking to each other through enthusiast press. They were having meetups. They were sharing secrets. And a lot of these people are still active to some extent or another with this machine and this community, even, decades later, which is how I was able to get in touch with a few of them for that video and talk to them about what they thought about this machine and its community.
Well, and just to sort of, expand on the whole, like, tear in your eye and reporting history correctly, not just sales numbers. It's almost like, I don't know if you share this feeling, but when I discuss things in those terms, it's almost like taking power back from the suits that put out statements at the time as being like the only voices for what this machine was, it's, and especially like Bally, which is like a casino company, it's like, no, that's not yours anymore. It's ours.
So before we go any further with this conversation, because, I mean, Frank said at the beginning, this is not a console that even he or I are super familiar with. And believe it or not, we love video game history. So I want to start by just kind of giving the audience a description of what the system actually is, mm-hmm. and like what its contemporaries were, and maybe even why no one, I don't want to say no one remembers it, but like, why is this not talked about nearly as much as like your Intellivisions and your, Ataris and ColecoVisions and that sort of thing? So what is it? What is the?
Oh, you want me to do it? Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's
I was waiting that's for fair. Kelsey to do it too. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
So this was a machine that was developed by sort of a Skunkworks R&D game development studio, essentially, called Dave Nutting Associates. They'd done a lot of work with Midway, which was owned by Bally. And as part of their work on coin-op games, they developed this whole microprocessor-based hardware. And one of the fellows who worked on this, Jeff Fredrickson, had the idea, like, hey, why don't we try and make a home version of this? We could do other things with this same hardware spec. So, they sort of developed it out a little further and made a console version. And they brought it up to, Bally, Midway's, ownership. And they were interested enough. They were doing some things in the, consumer retail space. Like, they were trying to sell home pinball machines, which also went about as well as you'd expect. And so this was sort of in the same general feeling. This was in 76, 77 when all this was taking place. And you look at the specs of this thing compared to what else was out at the time, like the Channel F, the Studio 2, the Atari VCS, and it kind of blows them away. Like, it has a Z80 microprocessor. It has a custom audio chip at a time when most machines were just sort of beeping. and you know, making little blips and all that fun stuff. It had 4 kilobytes of memory. In comparison, the Channel F has 64 bytes and the VCS has 128 bytes. Had 256 color palette. It had a lot of things that were very unusual at the time, and because of these factors, it could run really, really, really close home ports of Midway's big arcade games at the time. So, like, if you want to play 280 Zap or Seawolf or Amazing Maze, you could play those here. Like, they have Gunfight built into the machine, and that was one of their big hits.
You mentioned it's kind of the Neo Geo of its day is a decent comparison, at least for like where it was on the power scale, like and the ability to replicate the arcade games compared to what else was out there at the time.
Yeah, and also kind of on the price side of things, because this thing retailed for $300 at the time when I believe the VCS was selling for like $160. And that was, you know, the previous high end of the market. So this thing kind of blew all that away. And of course, because, you know, it was designed with the idea that, oh, we could expand this out into a computer, you could also look at it as the cheapest computer on the market at the time if you wanted to build your own keyboard, basically. But it's neither here nor there.
I mean, it's kind of an odd product at that point, right? It's like too expensive to be a video game machine, but not quite ready to be a computer. You know, it's operating this middle space that doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, like you could wholly understand why this machine did not take off, like in retrospect. I can understand at the time they didn't quite know what the market could support or would support. So, you know, they were just sort of taking shots in the dark, but yeah, they sold, I think I saw reported 28,000 units in its first year. And that was a delay on top of that, because it was supposed to come out in 77, but they had all kinds of issues getting approval through the FCC, which had very stringent radio frequency radiation requirements at the time.
Well, let me pause you there, because, you know, we're saying they, but we're not really talking about the company that actually, you know, so we talked about the people who made it. Right. Like the guys at Dave Nutting Associates. But I mean, OK, I'm from Vegas. So Bally, again, to me, that's a casino company. Right. Like that's a slot machine company. what is the path to them becoming a video game console, a consumer video game console creator and distributor?
So I guess the best way to put it is that Bally saw money in the market, especially after you had the big, you know, dedicated console fad in 76, 77, where they were selling, you know, millions of these freaking things. You know, not Bally, but the various companies that were selling them. So Bally saw money and Bally wanted in, and they already had, you know, Dave Nutting Associates on the line, so they sort of put this all together. And they were really not prepared for the consumer market because you know, Midway doing coin-op games, that's a different sort of beast entirely.
Well, like, what's the relationship there? Like, so Bally and Midway have a partnership at this point.
Bally owns Midway at this point. Yeah. So Midway is a subsidiary of Bally, and I think post 77, so is Dave Nutting Associates. I don't remember the specific date offhand. But yeah, so Midway, they deal with video games, but they're dealing with operators of arcade machines and, you know, distributors, and, you know, the sort of wear and tear on those machines. It's something that they have experience with. Wear and tear and like quality control and such. And distribution for a console is very different because you're selling to a lot more people, and you know that you have to make sure these things can stand up to all sorts of weird use cases you wouldn't expect. Like there's a big problem with the Bally units. that if you set them down on carpeting, they will overheat and die. And that's something that part of that is just because of the FCC shielding requirements that they had to put in. But also, it's just kind of how they designed the system. It was not really a thought.
That's something we've talked about before on this podcast a few times, but just to kind of remind people that that whole FCC thing was, it was basically, they thought there was going to be a lot of interference kind of radiating from these consoles. And so the way to pass their very strict standards about this was basically just wrap the whole thing in a bunch of metal, which, yes, heats the console up a lot. And that's why, you know, that's why a lot of those early consoles, even like the NES, just have this functionally useless metal shielding inside of there that makes it heavier and more expensive to produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a big issue for, you know, video games and computers in like the late 70s. The FCC amended their standards in the early 80s, so machines after that could get away with a little less stringency, but no such luck here for the Bally. And you go through the trade press. They didn't actually start shipping out any of these units until the very end of 77, so people weren't actually getting their hands on them until 78, which means they missed the Christmas market entirely and really pissed off their retail partners who had ordered all these machines and were advertising them and couldn't actually sell anything.
And this is the Christmas of the Atari VCS, right? And
yes. Yes.
What am I remembering right from your previous appearance? Maybe even the beginnings of the Intellivision, or was that a little later?
Intellivision was a little later. Okay, it was a couple of years later.
But yeah, I mean, they don't make Christmas, and what does make Christmas is the one that's like almost half the price, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a problem. And then they have all these quality control issues, so functionally, they can't really get a whole lot onto the market until basically the summer. It's not until about May that they really start getting a handle on those. So until that point, you know, the Bally Arcade may as well not be a factor on the market. Couple that with the giant price tag, couple that with angry distributors and retail partners that, you know, are getting blasted by their customers for having this thing that they may have pre-ordered just not coming in. And you got all kinds of issues. It's not too shocking that once gambling went to Atlantic City, Valley's like, you know what, that looks a lot more lucrative and a lot less expensive, so let's just offload this whole video game home console business and go do that.
So I think the way I'd like to sort of structure this conversation is, I think the commercial life of the system, as we kind of alluded to earlier, is maybe its least interesting aspect, right? So let's kind of front load that, right? Like, and then go back to the diverging timeline that sort of happens during its life, right? So this thing is introduced pretty much mid 78, handful of games, like nine games, right? Like decent launch, something around there. And to put this in perspective, these are just your typical, I mean, it's often literally like midway arcade ports, like you said, and but just the kind of games you would imagine from a video game console around then, like the Atari VCS adjacent arcade style games, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, how long does this last? Like what is the sort of trajectory of this system? Because it seems like it doesn't do that well, and they kind of trickle a few games out for a couple of years before they essentially pull the plug, right?
Yeah, so they put out a few more games in 79, including some really cool ones, like the football game on there. It's like four players, and the screen has sort of a flip scroll thing, so you can get the whole field in without, you know, needing to cram it all into one screen. And it's really interesting stuff. Obviously, no one's playing it because barely anyone bought the machine to begin with. So in 1980, just a few weeks into the year, Bally announces that they are looking to offload this machine to somebody else. They talk with a couple companies, and finally the one that takes it up is this little outfit out of Ohio called Astrovision, and later they change their name to Astrocade, which is why everyone today knows the machine is the Bally Astrocade, even though it was never really called that in its life, which is a very weird bit of accidental historical revisionism.
Wow. Did it not even say that on any of the boxes? I know originally it said Bally Professional Arcade on the boxes, but then it never said Astrocade on the box?
I have a box over here that says Astrocade, the Professional Arcade.
Okay.
So it was called the Astrocade, and it was called the Bally Professional Arcade. It was just never called both things at the same time.
Exactly.
Got it.
Yeah, it's very weird. They basically had the license to use the Bally name for it for a couple of years, and then after that they had to change the name of the machine, and that's sort of what they went with. They also changed the name of the company to Astrocade about the same time, just to, I don't know, get synergy going. So Astrovision, Astrocade, they were not very big, but they were sort of, they had company presidents, but really the power behind the throne there was this, was the VP of marketing, Ray George, who was really pushing for this thing and really saw money to be made in video games. I didn't talk to George because he'd already passed away, but I did talk with someone he worked with pretty closely, who went around like demonstrating a lot to distributors. And he told me at one point, it's like, yeah, you know, Ray was so charismatic that people would go into these meetings with him just irate, like they had product they couldn't get moving and they were really mad at him. And then they would leave with smiles on their face because he would just know exactly how to make everyone feel good and happy and like they've been heard and they've been, and they're being responded to. And you kind of get that impression just talking to him about, you know, about the guy he worked for and, you know, some of Ray George's comments in the press. Like, he was also apparently kind of a hard ass, and his incentives for sales were, you know, suspected to be a little odd. Like, it sounds like he may have been getting a commission, basically, based on, you know, getting stuff out to distributors. So he would just sort of get distributors and then give them stuff that wouldn't sell necessarily. So then they would be in breach of their contract. So he would find a new distributor and get stuff to them. So this cycle would just keep continuing. Like, I obviously can't ask George about this, but that was Meek's recollection of it. And he's like, yeah, it's the only way that makes sense, because we had games that people really wanted and were really interested in, and we were never like giving them enough copies of those. We were always dumping them off with these games that just weren't moving.
Gotta move this warehouse inventory.
So yeah, there were issues there. Ray George had issues with one of the big investors of the company, who eventually, because Astrocade was such a small outfit, they had trouble with manufacturing and, you know, money inflow and outflow. They ended up contracting with this investor, Jim Gurin's company Nitron, to basically produce all of the Astrocade hardware and software, like physical copies, and sell them back to him. And that was not a great deal for Astrocade, but they needed the money. There was a lot of concerns from George's side that Nitron would try and buy him out.
Where are we right now? Like 82, something like that?
Yeah, around 82. Okay. At this point, Dave Nutting Associates has sort of moved off to doing just coin-op hardware, and they've spun off a company called Action Graphics, which has the same like top-level investing team as Dave Nutting Associates, but is functionally its own company. And that's run by a former Dave Nutting Associates developer named Bob Ogden. And they're making games for the Astrocade. Eventually, they also make stuff for like the ColecoVision and the Commodore 64. But they were just working on this machine. And they were putting out some really cool stuff. They gave us a really cool artillery duel game, which got ported around to basically everything. It was a big success for them, relatively speaking. They were working on like a Conan the Barbarian game, which is like an arena fighter against computer opponents. It's really goofy. So they were doing some neat stuff as well. But things sort of came to a head about the same time that the video game market was melting down in general. Because they wanted to sell off their Astrocade business to a bigger company, basically. Someone who can actually put the kind of support behind it that it needs and, you know, get a nice payday out of it, too. So they were trying to sell it to Fisher-Price and to Hasbro, which, you know, they were involved in the video game industry in various ways. I think it was Fisher-Price who was the owner of US Games, which was making games for the Atari 2600. So they were interested. Ray George got offers from both of them, and for varying reasons, these fell through. At one point, he tried playing the two offers against each other, and that pissed off one of the companies, because it turns out the toy industry is very small, and everyone knows each other, and don't like to undercut each other like that. So didn't work out for them. They tried selling it in Europe, and like they started work on a PAL version of the video chip. They found an investment group, ITT, over in Germany that was interested in it, and then things fell apart there for reasons I delve into in the video. So eventually they sink into bankruptcy and never really quite get back out of it, which is the story for a lot of this. A lot of stuff in the video game collapse of 83. And I believe around 85, the rights to the system lapsed back to Bally Midway, which has proceeded to do absolutely nothing with them.
I mean, even, you know, we've made fun of the Intellivision Amico and stuff, but I feel like even the Intellivision, like most people have heard of that, but I get it. I don't know that there's much you can do with the Bally Professional Arcade System, even for a nostalgic round.
Well, I think most of the like Intellivision and ColecoVision like plug and plays were sold to people who didn't care about the brand. They just saw something that looked like a Space Invader and went, "Oh, old video games. That sounds fun," right? So like, if Bally or Midway, or I don't know, like Warner Brothers maybe has the rights at this point. I don't know. Like I could see a consumer product using it, but at the same time, I think why, you know, just like you could have, I mean, you could do, I talk about these NES plug and plays all the time, right? Like you could just have those guys in China make some quick retro games for you for nothing. And you don't have to like simulate the Bally Professional Arcade or whatever and use Midway IP.
I was just picturing like you'd have something like the SNK 40th where they had the home versions of a lot of those games. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, why not? Just have the home version of Seawolf on there as like an option.
Okay. Now we're getting somewhere, right? Like if it's like Midway History Collection, right? Like you could bring in the professional arcade stuff.
Like to be clear, I don't think the machine itself has any sort of market value, but there's some use cases for the actual games.
Oh, you and I share a love of, I mean, it'd be remiss to not bring up Dogpatch. Is the Bally Professional Arcade is the only system to house a version of Midway's arcade game Dogpatch, which is am I remembering right? You've never played the original. You've only played
I've never played the coin op. I've only played the home version.
So it's the opposite for me. I've only played the coin op. This is a brilliant game where it's basically volleyball, but you're shooting a tin can with a shotgun. So it's two players, and it is controlled with a paddle, and the paddle changes the degree of your shot, right, from 45 to 90. And there is a, you know, quote unquote ball, but it's a can, and there's a net in the middle, a line. And each volley you get two shots, right? So you could actually like get really good at like tilting up and setting yourself up to spike it, right? So you kind of shoot it like straight up, and then when it, as it's dropping down, you adjust your shot and you like shoot and spike it. It is a fantastic two-player game that you can't really play very well on MAME or whatever because of the controls. You also need two players for it to be fun. The Bally Professional Arcade, Astrocade hybrid system, it's the only one that's got it, baby.
And the home version's a little different. Like, okay. The home version does not limit you to two shots per side.
Really?
So, like, you can get a volley going that just keeps going, and each shot raises the value of the can. So once you knock it over the other person's head, like, however many shots, you get that many bonus points on top of however...
Wait, so you can just keep juggling it on your side infinitely?
I mean, it bounces forward the way it's designed.
Sure, but you can theoretically shoot it, like, three times before it goes over the net?
Yes, so that's kind of, like, a strategy I like to do, because each shot changes its trajectory, so you can, like... really sort of mess with the opponent and make them miss their shots when you're like bouncing it and then bam, sending it right over the
head. It's almost like a weird sequel, not a conversion. I love
it's super cool. I love that game. I have a friend, every time he comes by and I have like the Valley out somewhere to play, he's like, can we play Dog Patch? So
I think it's funny that I think if you and I were put in front of the other versions, we'd be like, that's not as good.
I mean, the arcade one does have like ways to get bonus points, and it's probably a little harder to cheese, so
yeah,
it's probably a little more competitive, but they're both really cool.
So before each can toss, does the home version say blaze away?
No, it says get ready boys, and then the like hillbilly in the middle throws
that's
the
also
coin
good
up.
Yeah, it's not as good get as ready blaze boys away.
I mean, yeah.
Blaze
they're,
away
they're
is good very
for
good.
Totally different reasons.
Yeah, like, it's a great game, and if I remember, that was the first game Astrocade published for the machine after they bought the rights from Bally.
God bless them. So it's probably, like, a product that was made and not manufactured yet or something like that.
Yeah, that was absolutely the case there. Like, it was a game that Bally had been promoting and then just didn't put out until Astrocade bought it out.
All right, so let's take back the narrative. Go for it, Kelsey.
we're going to start talking about the not corporate life of this system, and I mean, just how does this homebrew community start? How do people start engaging with this thing as more than just, you know, buy the video game on the shelf and put it in their console and play?
Now, the cool history. So it all comes down to one person, and that's Jamie Fenton. Who was a developer at Dave Nutting Associates, and she was asked to do a demonstration cart for a CES show. She did not want to write a demonstration cart for the CES show, and at the time she had been reading about Palo Alto Tiny BASIC, which was a version of BASIC designed for, you know, small computer systems that are like memory constrained and had limited inputs and all that fun stuff. And she thought that sounded like a much more fun project. So she started writing a version of BASIC for the Bally arcade. And then she finished a version of it so fast that her bosses thought it was super cool and were like, all right, we're going to show this at CES too, but we still need that demonstration cart. So she had to write that anyway.
That's how usually you're rewarded in the corporate world for doing a good job fast. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. and it had a really positive reception at CES. So,
all right, pause. What's BASIC? What does that mean?
BASIC. Yes. So this is a computer language that was developed in the 1960s, I think at Dartmouth, up in New Hampshire, to make programming, like easier for people to do, because at the time you were learning like assembly, or you were learning what was the big one at the time, was it Focal or it was something weird, some difficult computer language to like operate, and they're like, okay, well, here's one that we can write up, it'll use like human syntax basically, so, you know, you can use if then statements, and you actually typing if and then. There's like a run and input and all sorts of things. You can type in text real easily. So this was basically to make it easier for people to program, and it was a big success. It was a hugely popular at Dartmouth. It was pretty common to find versions of BASIC for basically every computer system at the through the rest of the 60s in the 70s. Like, even up into through the 90s, like, you know, Microsoft had Visual BASIC and QBASIC before that. So it had a long life. And so Palo Alto Tiny BASIC was a version for small machines that did not have a lot of memory. I can't remember any of the other ones off the top of my head, but the Bally Arcade fit that bill.
So this is a product that ends up being commercially sold, right?
Yes.
Like one could purchase the BASIC cartridge.
Yes.
One is using the limited built-in keyboard that's on the,
yep,
the system itself, right? And
yep.
So essentially you could put the cartridge in, turn the system on, you'd be, you know, greeted with a text prompt, and you could type in a game, run it as long as the system is on from memory, right? And yep, that's what you had functionally with the BASIC cartridge, right?
But what sets it apart from like the BASIC programming carts for other game systems like the VCS or the Odyssey 2's like assembly language cart is that you can save and load your programs. I think it's just this console and the Famicom that had like these BASIC programming carts that you could save and load programs to cassette on. So basically for this, the original version of BASIC, you'd had to buy a separate cassette interface, which was a 300 baud little piece of machinery that plugged into one of the controller ports, and it got power through the light pen jack that was never used for an actual light pen, but it was sure designed for one. You plug in your cassette player from there, and then you could load up a cassette that had a program on there. You could save your program to it. So functionally, if you were programming and you had to go do something else, you could save your progress and onto a tape, turn off the machine, come back to it, you know, however many days later, load it back up, and you're right where you left off. It's deeply annoying to program for this thing because you have a 24 key keypad and like a little overlay to let you do the different functions. And it's like kind of limited compared to the full power of the machine. Like you can only pick two colors at a time. And because it's BASIC and BASIC's not a super fast language, games, or especially early on, were kind of choppy, but you could make your own games for it. And so there is a newsletter from a fellow named Bob Fabris, who was a big fan of this machine and, you know, like a computer nerd. And he started putting out a, you know, like basically a one pager to like anyone who was interested, talking about the machine before the BASIC cartridge came out. And after it came out, he retooled his whole newsletter idea to sort of center around that. And so people would discuss programming tricks they'd learned. Some folks were talking about how they were reverse engineering like the system using the BASIC cartridge to like use the peek and poke commands to see what different registers on the system do. And using that information, they were able to start making things that were a little more complex, a little bit at a time, you know, new art demonstration games and whatnot. And
yeah, I think what was really cool about some of the stuff you showed is that it's not just people programming games, it's programming, you know, like art demonstrations, what we would now consider chiptune music, like covers of songs, just using the sound capabilities of the system, a little like animated cartoon kind of thing in pixels, which I thought was really cool. Just, you know, I think sometimes when people think of homebrew stuff, it's like, it's very tempting to just be like, okay, yeah, they made some little games, you know, probably some like tic-tac-toes and some simple stuff and, you know, maybe eventually some more complex stuff. But I think a lot of these systems, and this is, you know, I'm a big Wonderswan fan and there was a homebrew community for that too. They're doing stuff like so much more than just video games. Like they are treating this as just sort of a programming toolbox and just making whatever weird little ideas come to mind. And it's not always just video games, but it's all, you know, done using a video game system.
Yeah. And they were like sharing tools, like the people who were making a lot of these like musical songs using this machine, they were using tools made by other people who were not making, you know, music necessarily, but developed the tools for it, like the programming code. They were modifying each other's games because that was a big thing at the time. Like, take someone else's program and make tweaks to it and see what happens. And yeah, they were able to share all this stuff. And in the midst of all that, you had Jamie Fenton wading in yet again and surreptitiously publishing the Bally Basic Hacker's Guide in the Arcadian newsletter, like a couple chapters at a time. Eventually you could, you know, buy it all in one bundle if you wanted. And she went into all of the secret commands that she put into this program that let you access the machine language routines built into the operating system and the built-in games. So all of a sudden people were able to get into those and start speeding up their games, because, you know, you don't have to use BASIC to do your mathematical equations. Now you can just access the calculator on the system itself and do that in machine code much, much faster than you could otherwise. And that made a big difference in sort of the complexity of, you know, the games and the art programs that people were developing. And she also explained how to hack the cassette interface so that you could do other stuff with that same code. Or same code, same hardware, you know, and how to make sense of the expansion port on the back. It was really in-depth stuff that she just did because she was a hacker. And, well, she is a hacker. She's still around. And this just sort of was interesting to her.
So how do we get from here to people publishing and even selling games? I mean, the most immediate thing I can think of is, oh, there's now a market for, you know, running off cassettes that you sell through the mail. I mean, is this the kind of thing that starts emerging in this newsletter as sort of a network of indie game distribution?
Yeah, really early on too. Like, I think late 78, early 79, you start seeing ads for people selling cassettes and also just program listings at lower prices, which is pretty interesting. Like, prior to this video, I typed in a few of these program listings that the cassettes have never turned up for, but we still have these like printout copies. So got to type those in and, you know, see a game that no one's probably played in 40 years, which was a lot of fun.
But are these cassettes in the Digital Press Collector's Guide?
They are not, because, you know, they weren't cartridges, so they don't count.
All right.
But a lot of them are preserved online on ballyalley.com, which the guy who runs that, Adam Trionfo, is, you know, bless him and his crew for, you know, basically saving all of the history of this machine over the past 20 odd years. But anyway, yeah, so people were...
You can't see the salute we all just did, the secret hand salute that we do to pack rats, but we all just did it simultaneously. It was a really nice moment.
But yeah, so they were publishing through there. Other newsletters popped up that were doing the same thing. A couple of them actually made it into stores. So I got to talk to someone who worked at ABC Hobbycraft in Northern Indiana, which was still there.
Still around, you said, yeah. That made me, like, maybe the most excited of anything in that video. It was like,
it's still around.
Whatever and, like, ABC Hobbycraft is, it's still around. That makes me happy. Yeah.
But they were selling, like, cassettes of games right up into the mid-80s, even, for the Bally system. And apparently they did pretty good business at it over time because, you know, a lot of the other stores that were dealing in these cassette games were not doing that anymore, so... If you wanted them, you had to go to this source.
This takes us to like a question that I've had in just thinking about this. What still needs to be done for Astrocade preservation? Because so many of these games were, you know, maybe made on a couple of cartridges. But because they were part of this newsletter and this sort of ring or whatever, it's not like it was just one guy making a game and no one else saw it. It was something that other people did, you know, ostensibly type in and try and everything. So, I mean, is that what's missing right now, is just a lot of type-in stuff, or is there even more?
Well, and also, let's not gloss over what you just alluded to, which is people did end up making cartridges, right?
Like, yes. There were a couple cartridge games that were made by these sort of, you know, homebrew indie developers. Basically, a lot of them got their cartridge shells just from, you know, Bally, Dave Nutting Associates folks. They're like, hey, we want to make these games. And they're like, here, have some parts.
Yeah, we've got a couple plenty. Hundred spares here, right? But but also, didn't someone like make a mold to make new cartridges?
Yes. So one person did make a mold because he didn't realize he could just call up Midway and ask for them.
So, I mean, ostensibly, this is, you know, not that different in theory from like anyone making an Atari VCS game at the time, because there wasn't like a third party program, but it feels really different to me.
It feels more transgressive, I think, just from how they were promoting and selling this stuff. Like, feels more underground.
Well, it feels to me like the predecessor to the homebrew aftermarket, right? And that's what I find so fascinating about it. It's not like, you know, because these tended to be maybe individuals. They might have made companies or whatever, but they're just individuals. Let's just make them individuals.
Like a couple people.
Yeah, exactly.
Tops.
Right. And it's not like, you know, a company deciding to get into the video game market and figuring out how to make, like, this is essentially homebrew sold to and from, you know, by gamers for gamers, right? Like sold like to enthusiasts from enthusiasts. And like, I don't know, that to me feels like the proto homebrew market, and I want to make sure that we're sort of honoring that weird part of the system's history, because there's so many weird parts. But let just back to Kelsey's question, though. I didn't mean to interrupt it. Which is what's sort of left from a preservation perspective?
So there's quite a bit. So obviously there are type-in games that still need to be typed in. There was sort of a delay in getting those put together, partially because MAME, the emulator, did not support the Bally basic cassette interfaces until 2019. And that's mostly because the people who were working on that emulator did not realize that this was a function of the hardware. Mm-hmm. You could have a cassette interface. It had two of them, like the later version of the basic cartridge had a 2000 baud interface, which was much, much faster, but necessitated some tweaking to the program code. And then there was also the memory expansions that, you know, some of these enthusiasts were making and selling for this game system. And those used a special version of BASIC as well that Jamie Fenton had put together for them that would, you know, automatically look for these extra, you know, memory registers. And so, you know, those use either of the cassette interfaces, depending, but you still have to know to look for that stuff and add it in. So that was also missing for a long time.
Is MAME the like main emulator for this thing?
Yeah, there's no standalone emulator for this machine. Nobody's ever cared enough for that. And then there's a Mr. Core. The Mr. Core does not have support for the cassette interfaces or the memory expansion, because the person who wrote the core didn't know those were things, and no one has gone back and implemented it yet. Maybe one day.
God, this is dire. I wasn't expecting the answer to be this bad.
As far as software goes, yeah, there's the stuff to type in, and now it's possible to do that using MAME at least, and you can save it and all that fun stuff. You can also type them in into Notepad and use some, like, tools from the mid-2000s on PC to save them into a format that the machine can read. That only works for the 300 baud interface, but honestly, most of the stuff that's, you know, as a type-in listing only at this point is 300 baud, so it is what it is. And then there's the cassettes, and most of the cassettes I'm aware of have been like backed up, and they're online, and you can find them on Bally Alley. There's a bunch on archive.org, independent of that website, on top of that, because folks are still working on that.
There's a community.
There's multiple people who are like tracking down the folks who made these games and like checking to see if they still have their master copies and that sort of thing.
Wow.
So it's pretty wild. Valley Avengers. Shout out to Paul Thacker, especially, who's been doing a lot of legwork there. As of, I think, a couple weeks ago, they got a lead on a few from an outfit called the Tiny Arcade that were like really interesting looking. They're like something that looks like Space Invaders, but sort of multi-screen. We only have like the advertisement to go off of, so who knows exactly. But it sounds really cool, and I hope he does get that copy. But yeah, cassettes, I mean, there's probably always going to be some weird cassettes that are going to turn up. Like, I know last year someone found cassettes of games that someone made but never actually like distributed.
Mm.
And one of them was a version of Atari's Air Sea Battle for the Bally in BASIC. And they're like, yeah, it runs super janky, but it's Air Sea Battle.
Am I misremembering, but didn't some of the unshipped commercial product end up getting distributed as a cassette interface?
Yes.
Thing? Yeah.
Some of it, a lot of it got distributed as actual cartridges.
Okay.
Because they got copies of these like prototype cartridges and prototype code and just like made their own cartridges.
Like
and
back
sold
in
them,
the 80s, we're talking?
Back in the 80s, wow. Like 83 through like 85, a lot of these turned up.
Oh, so this really is like the beginning of all this stuff, because I don't imagine that's really happening with like the VCS yet at this point. Maybe it is, but
in a very limited capacity. Like, I think the best thing I can think of is Rob Fulop taking copies of his Cubicolor game that didn't come out at a Magic and
right.
selling his own copies of it. But that's like
80,
the next closest.
70,
like 86,
yeah.
87.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But like this, in this case, because a lot of these developers, these indie people, had such close connections with the folks at Dave Nutting Associates, who thought what they were doing was super cool.
Right.
They were happy to share this stuff, and I think surreptitiously, like, well, we have this Pac-Man game we can't sell. Well, why don't you guys do something with it? So you had Pac-Man, you had Conan the Barbarian, you had, I'm sorry, not Pac-Man, Munchie.
Mm-hmm.
You had like a soccer game, a checkers game, just some pretty neat stuff. Some of it neater than others, some of it more complete than others. But you could buy copies of it at the time if you knew the right store or were subscribed to these newsletters.
I think I think something else that I like about this whole thing is like, I don't know, that this is a system whose story challenges most conventions that we have, right? Like, and that includes now what is the canon library, right? Like,
yeah, there's like two dozen cartridges for this thing, and I'm pretty sure at least five or six of those are, you know, these like homebrew third party games,
right?
And then of the cassette stuff and like type in listings, there's hundreds. Like, I could not begin to give you a proper count of it. I know someone some years ago made a list of all these things, but it's not like numbered, and you know, you got all the different like provisions of it on there too. Like, I could not tell you the exact number of individual versions of these games. There's just a lot of them, and they get overlooked because when you think of video games, you don't think of cassettes, but here we are.
I guess another thing that comes to mind for me is that this is a really compelling story, that there was this community, and it's just a reminder that I don't know, games are made by people, right? Like, it's a reminder that, you know, the narrative that we can choose to have around a system is, you know, up to us, right? And I personally, after watching this, you know, don't care so much that Bally attempted to enter the market and failed, and brought some Midway home arcade ports with them. That's sort of interesting. But the tools inspired a community to spawn and support this system after the fact, is on its own interesting, but it's double interesting for me because all of this feels like a predecessor to what we would call like the homebrew market that emerged in like, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, around systems like the Atari and later the NES. Like this feels like it followed most of the same beats, right? Where it's like people wanted more software for the system. It wasn't officially being supported. Tools came out, tools got better, games got better. And like that leads to this stuff. And I don't know. It's just neat seeing, you know, a proto 80s version of communities that I thought were brand new ideas in my nascent internet days.
Yeah. That's sort of the thing that when I was structuring this video out, I'm like, okay, I want to put this part and the back half, because first, it's the history most people are not going to know. And secondly, it's like a celebration of this machine. Like these people took this thing that was not popular and like, basically you had this like small crowd that liked it of, you know, however many tens of thousands or however many, and they made something like really unique and really special and interesting with it. And they became friends, and some of them went on to do interesting stuff in like tech and video games, and some of them didn't, but they still stayed friends and they still hang out. And like people are still doing stuff occasionally with this hardware. Like literally a week ago, I saw someone post up in the Bally like groups IO because, you know, they're so old school with this thing that they're still using like email newsletter groups or email groups. Yeah.
Cool.
They just made a new homebrew game for this thing. Like it's like a puzzle game based off of other puzzle games that he really liked. He's like, I bet I could do a version for the Bally. So he programmed it in BASIC and it works. And that's just cool. Like people are still doing stuff with this hardware occasionally.
Well, I think that about wraps up our discussion. Anything else you wanted to slip in right at the end here, Kevin, or have we sort of covered it?
I will add that there is some really cool stuff about this machine, and you know, I wholly encourage anyone who can get MAME set up to use it properly, which is a little bit of a mess because like it's a 24 key keypad that expects you to have an overlay, so you kind of have to like figure out how to work those buttons, and there's like a YouTube guide, I think. But I encourage anyone who's willing to take that plunge to check out some of these cassette programs, because they're super cool and they're really really fun.
Well, cool. Thanks again, Kevin, for joining us on the Video Game History Hour again. We hope to have you back in the future. We will link to pretty much everywhere you can find Kevin on the internet. We highly recommend his Atari Archives YouTube and Patreon, where, among other things, you can get the scripts to his episodes, which made my notes a whole lot faster this episode. So I really appreciate that. But for those listening, where can people quickly find you on the internet and follow you around?
I'm on several most social media sites. I'm on Twitter under Ubersaurus still. I just got on Blue Sky, like as of yesterday, under Ubersaurus as well. I'm on Mastodon at ubris@mastodon.social. And I have a book you can check out.
That's right, you have a book. My God, I forgot.
Atari Archive. Yeah, Atari Archive Volume 1, 77-78. It's ostensibly covering the first 2 years of the VCS's history and goes in depth on that system's like creation and the history behind each of its games, but also delves into sort of the broader history of the video games, the home video game space in general at that time, and what its competitors were up to and doing, including the Bally Arcade.
And you can find that book on limitedrungames.com. Thanks again, Kevin, for joining us on the Video Game History Hour.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunamune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.